He had carefully selected the best specimen of the carved stone birds, the only one that was completely undamaged, and the one on which the carving was the most artistically executed. And he had packed and prepared it for portage himself. For Zuga, the carving was physical proof of the existence of the ancient abandoned city, proof that could not be denied when even the most cynical critic read his account in faraway London. Zuga guessed that the intrinsic value of this relic probably surpassed the equivalent weight in pure gold. The value of the artifact was not the most important consideration in Zuga's determination to carry the carving out to civilization. The stone birds had come to have a special superstitious significance to him. They had come to symbolize for him the success of his endeavors, and by possessing one of them, he had in some strange manner taken possession of this entire savage and beautiful land. He would return for the others, but he must have this single perfect specimen. It was his talisman. "You and you," he picked two of his strongest and his usually most willing porters. And when they still hesitated, he unslung the heavy elephant gun from his shoulder. They saw his expression and knew that his intention was serious, deadly serious. Sulkily, they began breaking down their own loads and distributing them amongst their comrades. "At least let us leave this other thundering piece of rubbish." The rain and the cold had affected Jan Schurut as much as the others, and he indicated the tin box that contained Zuga's dress uniform with a hatred and contempt usually reserved for animate objects. Zuga did not bother to reply, but gestured to Matthew to take it up. It was noon before the bedraggled little column struggled through the long sodden grass that choked the valley floor and began to climb the far side, slipping and cursing in the mud. It rained for 5 days and five nights, sometimes in thick drumming bursts that seemed to fall in solid sheets of water from the sky. At other times it was a cold, drizzling mist that swirled gently about them as they trudged on in the soft, treacherous footing, a fine silver mist that blanketed and muted all sound except the eternal dripping of the forest and the soft, sighing passage of the wind in the upper branches. The fever vapours seemed to rise from the very ground, entering their lungs with each breath, and in the icy cold mornings they writhed and twisted like the wraiths of tormented souls down in the hollows of the valleys. The porters were the first to show the symptoms of the disease, for the fever was in their bones, and the cold rain brought it out, so they shivered in uncontrollable spasms, and their teeth chattered in their jaws until it seemed they might crack like porcelain. However, they were seasoned to the rigours of the disease, and they were still able to march. The bulky statue, in its ungainly packing of grass and bark, was borne painfully up the rocky ridges and down the other side by half-naked men staggering like drunks from the fever boiling in their veins. And when they reached the bank of another watercourse, they dropped it gratefully and fell in the mud to rest without the will to cover themselves from the relentless rain. Where there had been dried riverbeds, with drifts of white sand shining like alpine snowfields in the sun, with quiet pools of still green water, and with steep high banks in which the brilliant kingfisher and little jeweled bee-eaters burrowed to nest, there were now maddened torrents of racing brown water, which brimmed over the high banks and carved out the roots of tall trees, toppling them into the flood and whisking them away as though they were mere twigs. There was no possible means by which a man could cross these racing, foaming deluges. The corpse of a drowned buffalo, with bloated pink belly and its limbs sticking stiffly into the air, were borne downstream at the speed of a galloping horse, while Zuga stood morosely on the bank and knew that he had left it too late. They were trapped by the spate. "We'll have to follow the river," he grunted, and wiped his streaming face onto the sleeve of his sodden hunting jacket. "It goes towards the west," Jan Schurut pointed out with morbid relish, and it was not necessary for him to expand on the thought. To the west lay the kingdom of Mzilikatsi, king of the Matabili, and already they must be close to that vaguely defined area that old Tom Harkness had marked on his map. "The burnt land, where Mzilikatsi's impis kill all travellers," "What do you suggest, my ray of golden Hottentot sunshine?" Zuga demanded bitterly. "Have you got wings to fly this?" He indicated the broad expanse of wild water, where the curled waves stood as stationary as carved sculptures as they marked the position of submerged rocks and hidden snags. "Or what about gills and fins?" Zuga went on. "Let me see you swim. Or if you have neither wings nor fins, then surely you have good advice for me." "Yes," Yan Shirut answered as bitterly. "My advice is that you listen to good advice when first it is given, and second that you drop those in the river." He indicated the bundled statue and the sealed uniform box. Zuga did not wait for the rest of it, but turned his back and shouted, "Safari! On your feet, all of you! We march!" They worked slowly west and a little south, but too much westward for even Zuga's peace of mind, though his route was dictated by the network of rivers and flooded valleys. On the sixth day, the rain relented, and the clouds broke open, revealing a sky of deep aquamarine blue and a fierce swollen sun that made their clothing steam and stilled the fever shakes of the porters. Even with the accuracy of his chronometer in doubt, Zuga was able to observe the meridian passage that local noon and establish his latitude. He was not as far south as he had calculated by dead reckoning, so he was probably even further west than his suspect calculations of longitude suggested. "The land of Mzilikatsi is drier," Zuga consoled himself, as he wrapped his navigational instruments in their oilskin covers. "And I am an Englishman and the grandson of Chedi. Not even a Matabele would dare deny me passage, despite what old Tom writes." And he had his talisman, the stone bird, to add its protection. Resolutely he faced the west again, and drove his caravan onwards. There was one other misery to add to their sufferings. There was no meat, and there had been none since the day they had left the abandoned city. With the first onslaught of the rains, the great herds of game that had been concentrated upon the last few pools and waterholes had been freed to scatter widely across the vast land, where every ditch and irregularity was now at last brimming with fresh sweet water, and where the baked and sun-seared plains were already blooming green with the tender first shoots of new growth. In 5 days' march in the rain, Zuga had seen only one small herd of waterbuck, the least palatable of all African game, with its rank, turpentine-scented musk which permeates the flesh. The heavily built bull, in his shaggy plum-brown coat, led his small troop of hornless females at a frantic gallop across Zuga's front, with his wide lyre-shaped horns cocked high and the perfect white circle over his buttocks flashing with each bound. He tore through the drizzling rain and dense wild ebony bush not 20 paces from Zuga. Zuga threw up the heavy gun and led on his driving shoulder. Behind him, his hungry, exhausted porters yipped like a pack of hunting dogs with anticipation, and Zuga held his aim for an instant to make deadly certain and then squeezed off the trigger. With a sharp crack, the cap exploded under the falling hammer. But there was not the long spurt of flame from the muzzle and the great clangor of the shot, followed by the heavy, thumping impact of the lead ball into flesh. The gun had misfired, and the handsome antelope led his harem away at full gallop, disappearing almost immediately into the bush and rain, while the dwindling clatter of their hooves mocked Zuga. He swore with frustration as he laboriously drew the ball and charge with the corkscrew tool fitted to his ramrod, and found that the insidious rain had somehow entered the barrel, probably through the nipple, and that the powder was as wet as though he had dipped it in the raging brown floodwaters. Those few hours of fierce sunlight on the sixth day gave Zuga and Yan Shirut an opportunity to spread the coarse grey contents of their powder bags on a flat rock and dry it out, so there would be less chance of another disastrous misfire. And while they did so, the porters let drop their packs and limped off to find a dry spot to stretch their aching limbs. Then, too swiftly, the sunlight was blotted out once again, and hurriedly they scooped the powder back into the pouches. And as the fat raindrops began to hiss and splat about them, they wrapped them in the warm oilskins, tucked them under their voluminous leather capes, and resumed the westward trudge, heads bowed, silent and hungry and cold and miserable, Zuga's ears singing with the quinine buzz, the first apparent side effect of massive doses of the drug taken over long periods. The quinine buzz that can lead to eventual irreversible deafness. Despite the heavy daily doses of the bitter powder, the morning arrived at last when Zuga woke with the deep ache in the marrow of his bones, the dull weight like a heavy stone lying behind his eyes, and by midday he was shaking and shivering with the alternate flood of fierce heat and deathly sepulchre cold through his veins. "The seasoning fever," Yan Sharut told him philosophically. "It kills you or hardens you. Some individuals would appear to have a natural resistance to the ravages of this disease," his father had written in his treatise, "The Malarial Fevers of Tropical Africa, Their Causes, Symptoms, and Treatment. And there is evidence to suggest that this resistance is hereditary." "We'll see now if the old devil knew what he was talking about," Zuga mumbled through chattering teeth, hugging the stinking wet leather coat around his shoulders. It never occurred to him, even briefly, to halt for his affliction. He had not accorded that courtesy to any of his men, and he did not expect it himself. He trudged on grimly, with his knees giving a rubbery little bounce at each pace, his vision blurring and starring into little pinwheels of light, then emerging again, though phantom worms and gnats still wriggled across his sight. Every now and then a touch upon his shoulder from the little Hottentot who marched behind him directed Zuga's stumbling feet back onto the path from which they had strayed. The nights were hideous with the nightmares of his fever-inflamed brain. They were filled with the buffeting thunder of dark wings and the sickly stench of snakes, so that he would wake panting and screaming, often to find Yan Sharut holding him with a comforting arm around his shaking shoulders. The lifting of that first bout of his seasoning fever coincided with the next brief break in the rains. It seemed that the bright sunlight, magnified by the lingering moisture in the air, burned away the mists from his mind and the poisonous miasma from his blood, leaving him clear-headed, with a fragile sense of well-being, but a weakness in his legs and arms and a dull ache up under the right-hand side of his ribcage, where his liver was still swollen and hard as a rock, the typical after-effect of the fever. "You'll be all right," Yan Sharut prophesied. "You threw it off as quickly as I've seen any man with his first hit of the fever. Ja, you are a man of Africa. She will let you live here, my friend." It was while he still walked on wavering legs, light-headed, so that it felt as though his feet did not touch the muddy earth but danced inches above it, that they cut the spoor. The weight of the great bull had driven the spoor a foot deep into the sticky red mud, so that it was a series of deep potholes strung across the earth like beads on a necklace. The exact impression of the huge pads had been cast in the holes as though in plaster of Paris. Each crack and fissure in the skin of the sole, each irregularity, even the outline of the blunt toenails, were there in precise detail. And at one place, where the soft earth had been unable to bear his weight, and the elephant had sunk almost belly deep, he had left the impression of his long, thick ivories in the earth when he had used them to push himself free. "It's him," breathed Yan Sharut without looking up from the enormous spoor. "I would know that spoor anywhere." He did not need to say more to identify the great old bull that they had at last seen so many months before on the high pass of the elephant road on the escarpment of the Zambezi River. "Not an hour ahead of us," Yan Sharut went on in a reverential whisper, like a man at prayer. "And the wind stands fair," Zuga found he was whispering also. He remembered his premonition that he would encounter this animal again. Almost fearfully, he looked up at the sky. In the east, the storm clouds were rolling ponderously towards them once more. The brief respite was almost over. The next onslaught of the storm promised to be as fierce, and even those deep and perfect prints would soon dissolve into liquid mud and be washed into oblivion. "They are feeding into the wind," he went on, trying to put the threat of rain out of his mind and concentrating his still fever-dulled wits to the problem of the hunt. The old bull and his remaining consort were feeding and moving forward with the wind into their faces. That way they would not walk into trouble. Yet these two old veterans, with their decades of accumulated experience, would not hold steadily into the wind for long. They would turn at intervals to get below the wind of a possible tracker. Every minute now was a vital consideration if the hunt was to succeed, for despite the weakness in his legs and the silliness in his head, Zuger had not for a single moment considered letting the spoor go. They might be 100 miles within the borders of Mzilikazi's country, with the Matabele Impi of border guards closing swiftly, and the hours lost in following the two old bulls might make all the difference between escaping from these fever-haunted forests or leaving their bones here for the hyena to crunch. But neither Zuger nor Jan Sharut hesitated. They began to shed their unneeded equipment. They would not need water bottles, for the land was overflowing. The food bags were empty anyway, and the blankets sodden. They would shelter tonight against the old bull's massive carcass.